This is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
And I'm Steve Hayward. This week, it's the Psychology of Performance episode.
We talked to Dr. Christy Ertle about sports superstition, the mental game of sports performance, and how to heckle effectively.
In almost all athletics, the goal is to be automatic, to not think.
The great Goose himself, Hall of Fame pitcher Goose Gossage, tells us about the highs and the lows of life on the mound.
You know, I've always said that every life's lesson is out there on that baseball field.
Conductor Scott Yu gives us his perspective of what it means to step up to the plate with a baton.
If you are playing the most intense moment of the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto and you are seizing up because you're so excited, oh my God, isn't this awesome? It's just not going to be awesome.
And Idris Goodwin talks about the teaching of performance and the path to perdition.
Teaching is like the ultimate performance for an audience that would rather be elsewhere.
It's Off Topic. It's the Psychology of Performance episode. Stay with us. Professor Stillman's nickname on the faculty baseball team was Hammer. It was not a nickname that he had picked, but one that had been picked out for him, bestowed upon him abruptly last week in the midst of a softball game. "Come on, Hammer," said Professor Wright. He was a tall, bald man who taught in the religion department. "Don't hurt him, Hammer," he shouted. It took Stillman two strikes to realize Professor Wright was speaking to him. "Are you referring to me?" Professor Stillman asked. "Am I Hammer?" "Strike three," called the ump. "You're out." Stillman let the bat fall from his shoulder and retreated to the bench. He sat down, dejected, and the coach of the team, a 91-year-old emeritus professor from the history department named Hockman, came over to commiserate. "Never mind, Hammer," he said. "It happens. When I turned 70, it was the same thing." "I'm not 70, Stillman pointed out. "I'm not even 50. Hockman nodded. "The swing is the first to go. Next, you can't lift the bat. "I can lift the bat, said Stillman. "I have no trouble lifting the bat. "Next thing you can't see to catch a fly ball, said Hockman, going on. "Then it's your hair, your knees. I had a hip transplant, both sides, one after the other. Did me wonders. You should think about it." "I don't need a hip transplant," Stillman tried to tell him. "I struck out. Once." "This is how it starts, Hammer," said Hockman. "Did I ever tell you the story about when I got pulled out of the water during the Normandy invasion? Now that was a good day. They can't all be days like that. Sometimes, Hammer, you strike out." "Why are you calling me Hammer?" Stillman wanted to know. "I don't know," he said. "Wright said it, and it stuck. It's your nickname now. Nothing you can do about it." As Stillman jogged out into the field for the bottom of the third inning, he stopped and asked Professor Wright what he'd been thinking when he gave him the nickname Hammer. Professor Wright said it had to do with curling. The hammer is the guy who throws the last stone in a curling match, the guy who decides whether his team wins or loses. Stillman was a Canadian, and everybody knows Canadians are into curling, so Stillman was Hammer. Stillman didn't like the sound of it. He didn't feel like a hammer. The nickname filled him with a sense of foreboding, of unidentifiable dread. "Actually," said Stillman, "I'd prefer you didn't call me that." "Okay, Hammer," said Professor Wright. "Seriously," said Stillman. "You got it. Hammer." Seeing it was no use, Stillman took up his position at third, and the first batter popped the ball up, hit it straight up into the air, right over third base. Stillman had his glove up and was ready. "I have this," he thought. And a moment later, he lost sight of it in the high-altitude Colorado sunshine. He blinked and then blinked again and heard the ball land behind him in the grass. "Sorry about that," he told Hockman when the inning was over. "I don't know what happened." "It's not your day, Hammer," replied Hockman. "Sometimes you hammer, and other days you get hammered. There are both kinds of days in this life." Eventually, the game ended, and when it did, Stillman was relieved. It was only a game, he told himself. It was striking out and missing a fly ball. That was it. But then he realized he'd locked his keys in his car. Leaning down and looking through the car window, he could see them there, glinting in the passenger seat. Hockman came up behind him and looked in through the window with him. "Those your keys?" said Hockman. Stillman nodded. He knocked at the car window, as if there was a chance the keys might somehow hear him and open the door. "Now you're thinking," said Hockman. He handed Stillman the baseball bat. "Go ahead," he said. "Do it." "I could probably just call my wife and she'd bring me the spare set," said Stillman. "I don't know if I need to smash the window."
"Or maybe you do need to smash the window," said Hockman. "There are days when you call your wife to bring the spare set of keys, and there are days when you take the bat and you smash the window. There are days when you look around for a toothbrush, and days when you just put the toothpaste on your finger. The thing is, you gotta ask yourself, what kind of day is it going to be?"
Stillman looked at the baseball bat in his hand and at the car window. He wondered if it was possible. Did you just wake up one morning and start smashing windows? Would he have to start dressing differently? Would he have to grow a mustache? It was too much to contemplate, so he acted on impulse. Stillman raised the baseball bat, and the window shattered into 1,000 pieces.
"Like a real ball player," said Hockman, and clapped his hands.
Stillman looked at the shattered glass littering the pavement.
"You better get out of here," said Hockman, who was already walking quickly toward his own car.
On the way home, the warm breeze felt good on Stillman's face as it came in through the windowless door. He said nothing to his wife, not about striking out, not about missing the fly ball, and nothing about smashing the window. But he could still feel it in his hands, the bat breaking through the window, how the shattered glass showered him like drops of rain. "I got a nickname today," he told his wife that evening. "They're calling me Hammer." "Why would anyone call you Hammer?" asked his wife. She sounded, thought Stillman, a little too surprised. Why shouldn't he be called Hammer? Standing at the bathroom sink, he caught a glimpse of his reflection in the mirror. He was a middle-aged man with glasses, soft in the middle. There are days when you hammer and days when you are hammered. The trick, the task, is in being able to tell them apart. He reached for his toothbrush, then changed his mind. He extended his index finger and squeezed the toothpaste onto it. "It's hammer time," he said out loud to his own reflection. This was a good day.
Can't touch this. Can't touch this.
This is Off Topic. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray. And this week we're talking about the psychology of performance, about what it takes mentally to perform in public. I have a horrifying memory that is 45 years old, that is from when I was in kindergarten, when I completely destroyed the kindergarten Easter play by having a panic attack, basically, in the middle of it. And it led to the complete and utter destruction and chaos. And it became clear to me at that moment that I was not cut out to be a performer.
Like, what happened exactly?
We had these little cutout Easter eggs that we were supposed to stand in front of. It was a Catholic school, and so after we did the Easter Bunny songs, we were supposed to gently put those down on the ground to sing our religious songs. But I was so paralyzed with fright that I couldn't bend down to put it down. So I let go of it, and it slid across the floor, whirled up into the air, hit the first row of parents in the face, and caused all of the children to start screaming hysterically with laughter, and then figuring out whether they could make their Easter egg do that too. Utter chaos amongst the five-year-olds.
And everybody said, "She has a future in showbiz." What makes performance so difficult, whether we're on the athletic field, whether we're playing an instrument, whether we're throwing a fastball, it's the way in which you have to accomplish the thing right now.
But people have enormous anxiety about this. When I think, I performed folding laundry earlier this morning. I have to say I performed it fabulously well. And I had no anxiety about that. Whereas when people think, I'm going to step up to the plate, I'm going to step onto the stage, that is something more than just I'm doing something. It's I'm doing something in public.
There's a way in which the audience makes the performance occur.
And I think it's that the presence of the audience really gives the situation a lot of tension that's very fraught, because I think one of the things that performers try to do is get some control over this situation, get some control over aspects of their performance, get some control in a situation where we may not really have as much control as we would like.
Where we can't have the kind of control that we like, where the kind of control that we would like is that which necessarily eludes us.
We talked to Dr. Christy Ertl, a professor in the psychology department at Colorado College.
And a former collegiate long jumper.
Who has a fascinating body of work looking at superstition and performance amongst athletes.
Superstition in sports gets a lot of play. And because athletes are in the public eye and we see their superstitions, we see them kissing their medals and we see that they've worn the same socks or they talk about wearing the same socks, they're in the public eye. So it's unclear actually whether athletes have a significantly higher rate of superstitious behavior, although they have the more opportunities than other people. The competition is usually quite close among, for instance, professional athletes. There's very little difference between the highest ranking people in almost any sport. And so if there's very little difference physically, psychologically between these people, what edge can you try to get to try to beat that person? And therefore, it's in psychology, it's called the uncertainty hypothesis. You know,
what is it? It's called the
uncertainty hypothesis. I don't know if I can do anything that will guarantee me beating you. So I'm going to go to my St. Christopher medal, or I'm going to wear this or do this and see whether I can command the fates to help me in that regard.
But you found that athletes were superstitious differently depending on their skill level and what they were doing, right?
Yes. Yeah. The one study that we published a few years ago, which was with a student, Perry Wright, who is now at graduate school in sports psychology at Springfield College. This was his thesis, which is so fun when a thesis can be published. But he built a golf putting range in the psych department. And we had a study where we brought in undergraduates and had a difficult putt and an easy putt. Now, for me, of course, both of those would be difficult. But the 3-foot putt was considered easy. The 9-foot putt was considered difficult. And these folks had different varying golf abilities. And it turned out that the folks who were skilled at golf were superstitious when they were doing the difficult putt, but not the easy putt. And the folks who did not have high skill, like me, they were more superstitious in the easy putt, the 3-foot putt, but not in the difficult putt. And so it was a matter of where you thought that fate could help you, because the unskilled people had completely learned helplessness about the 9-foot putt. There's no way I was ever going to get that, you know? So
even the gods can't
right,
help
the gods
me.
Can't even help me, exactly. So I might as well, think about superstition or act superstitiously in the 3-foot putt. And then for the highly skilled or the skilled golfers, they didn't have to worry at all about the 3-foot putt. They got it, you know, every time, so that no superstitious behavior needed. But in the difficult putt, it was still challenging for them. And of course, now as we defined superstitious behavior, there was Perry had 4 different colored balls, and we defined superstitious behavior as taking the same colored ball that you made the last putt on, and if that was different from chance with the 4 up.
The lucky blue ball is
the
one I'm going to go with.
Exactly. Right?
But couldn't superstitions actually help people make you better, because mm-hmm. it loosens you up? And, you know, if you feel like the gods are on your side, mm-hmm. maybe you do better.
Mm-hmm. Well, 2 years after that study was published, some colleagues in Europe, Damish and her colleagues, actually did a set of 4 studies that looked at superstitious behavior and performance. And not just when does superstitious behavior arise, but does it give you an edge? And among the 4 studies, she found that, in fact, the people who engaged in superstitious behavior did better on, I think there was a golf task, there was a memory task, and other things. So they were allowed to bring in their talismans, and they were told that this was a lucky ball or not. And so they actually gave an edge in all 4 of the studies.
Was, in fact, a lucky ball.
Yeah. Well, it was a lucky brain, perhaps, that thought it was a lucky ball. Yeah.
Is that the takeaway from it, that we think about superstition as having to do with what we can't do? We ask for fate to intervene when we feel like we're helpless. But really, what we're doing when we ask for fate to intervene and help us, you know, throw that touchdown pass, kick that field goal, get the horseshoe around the peg, what we're really talking about there is what we know we can do. Is that it? Like, it's like what superstition is really showing us is our ability rather than mm-hmm. our inability.
That's a really nice way of phrasing it. In the study that we did, when we compared the two ends of the spectrum, one being a superstitious behavior as a positive thing, you know, that the people were still in it. They were still fighting. You know, they were still trying to get anything to help them. Whereas the folks who, for instance, the low-skilled group in the 9-foot putt, you know, they gave up. There was learned helplessness. There wasn't any appealing to the fates anymore. And in athletics, of course, that's the worst outcome you can imagine, is giving up. And we kind of construed superstitious behavior as being, you're still in it, you're still fighting, and not necessarily as a bad thing. And now, of course, the paper afterwards has shown that it really isn't a bad thing, even in the performance outcomes. But we definitely didn't construe it as a wholly negative.
Are you an athlete yourself?
I was a sprinter and a hurdler, and my talent with kind of my shortness, once people started getting taller, my sprinting and hurdling were overshadowed by others. But I could convert speed into height and distance, and that's not something that really, really tall people can do. So I've been long jumping since I was in 10th grade. And actually, I should say, I just ended 2 years ago. So I was...
Is that right? your long jumping career has extended and overlapped your work in sports
psychology. Yes, well, I wouldn't say it's a long jumping career. It's a fun thing to do. I was doing master's meets up until 2 years ago, and I broke my wrist.
You know, I remember doing the long jump myself. I did some track, and I had this elaborate ritual that I would do. Did you have something like that? Like you'd have to, you know, spin around 3 times, you know, touch your head, you know, like the thing that if you had to do it or the jump would be no good.
You were watching. No. In fact, I was not very superstitious as an athlete. I was very anxious, as I think most athletes are, before competitions, but I didn't have any superstitious rituals or clothing or anything like that. When I saw other people doing it, I found it fascinating. And my students at Colorado College have found it fascinating as well. But no, personally, I did not have any superstitious rituals.
We've been speaking with Dr. Christy Ertl about the mental game of sports performance.
Stay with us.
Welcome back to Off Topic. I'm Kathy Giffray.
I'm Steve Hayward.
And we're talking to Professor Christy Ertl about the psychology of performance.
I'm just sort of going to go back to your long jump days here. Would it be that you would, you know, stride out onto the field and they'd be like, here comes the professor? In a sense, like that you were not only an expert at long jump, you not only had the distance going for you, but you knew what to say to other people to intimidate them. Is that right? Is that like the dark side of being in sports psychology? That you know you're like a kind of Picasso of heckling. You're virtuoso.
They call it psyching someone out for a reason.
Now, I'm not saying that I have ever gone to a hockey game or a football game or a baseball game. I'm not saying that I've ever played squash with anyone and thought to myself, what can I say to throw them off their game? But I think that it's something that has, I don't think I'm a shallow person to say, it's crossed my mind. And if you were going to Not that you would give us advice about effective heckling.
Of course not.
But what if you were to give us advice about effective heckling?
What would it be?
Well, there is a literature, strangely enough, in sports psychology about choking under pressure. And, of course, this literature did not evolve from the dark side. It evolved from trying to identify how to stop athletes from choking under pressure. And so the literature, of course, looks at when does that happen? Why does that happen? And then, of course, the dark side of that literature is, well, how can you make somebody choke under pressure? Which is not really what I teach in my class, but we do discuss it. But yes, so with that caveat, let's get right to it. Well, most of the time, sports fans can affect the behavior of other teams in certain situations more than others. So when you have like the closed situation, like a free throw shot, things like that, you know, you have an opportunity to inject some information to the free throw shooter. If you are in an ongoing sport like hockey, who's staying in one place at all the time? The goalie, okay? So you have an opportunity, you know, to communicate with the goalie. The thing about choking under pressure is that in almost all athletics, the goal is to be automatic, to not think. You know, as soon as you start thinking, things start falling apart. Everything should be practiced to the point where you don't have to think. You just react, or you just do like a free throw what you've planned on doing for all of the tens of thousands of free throws that you've practiced. So, what we find that when people choke is when they start to think. And if a fan, for instance, hypothetically, were to encourage that individual to be thinking about what they're doing, okay, then that is an opportunity to affect that person. Now, whether that athlete is listening or not is wholly up to that athlete. And if I were a coach, I would be trying to encourage them not to be listening. However, in those situations, if everything is supposed to be automatic, you want to draw attention to what should be automatic. So yelling things about their orientation or what, you know, their name on their back, that doesn't really have much of an impact. But in hockey, for instance, in a goalie, if you were to get their attention to the five hole between their legs, mm-hmm. you know, watch the five hole, well, that is something that they should be, that should be automatic, but now it's conscious. That's and now, you know, so.
Heckling has to be relevant.
Yes,
or
exactly.
Even you could be screaming something that seems helpful to them. Be sure right. and do
right.
this.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Bringing attention to their hand on the ball. Their, you know, that anything that they shouldn't be paying attention to is potentially problematic for them.
I sometimes work swim meets where I'm timing swimmers, and before they get in the water, I always say to them, "Swim fast." Which is a subtle allusion to the movie Meatballs and Bill Murray, who has, I think, the great piece of sports psychology insight. I don't know if you remember Meatballs. I don't know if you have
it's
that.
It's a fabulous movie.
I don't know if you have it at your fingertips, Dr. Ertl. But it's a high jump moment at the end of Meatballs that it turns on. And Bill Murray says, "Jump really high to the high jumper," which – if I'm hearing you right, it's good advice.
Yeah.
The best advice you can do, the best advice you can give to an anxious athlete is none.
Mm-hmm.
Is
yes,
that right?
Absolutely. Because it just do what you know how to do. That's the best advice. I mean, that's not trying to interfere with them. The instilling the confidence that you've practiced this. You know how to do it. I'm not anxious. You shouldn't be anxious. That's for the immediacy right before an event. It's just do what you know how to do.
I was interested when you were talking about, you said you're a former long jumper. And I think that, you know, when one gets to be a certain age, you know, I think of my own athletic career. I think I'm in the lion in winter stage, you know. I think of that poem, Ulysses, "Though I am not strength," and I forget the rest of it. "Though I am not that strength which once moved earth and heaven, what remains remains." And I wonder if you talk about, you know, maybe in terms of, like, one of the things that, you know, my relationship to sports has changed. Like, it used to be believing that you could do that or pushing yourself to do that. And now it's really in some way the opposite. I wonder if you have any thoughts mm-hmm. on that kind of twilight.
Mm-hmm. Right, the twilight of our athletic careers. It was truly a moment, not a midlife crisis moment, but a moment when I first called myself a former athlete. And in fact, that happened before I stopped long jumping entirely because I took a hiatus, if you will, from college to the age of 40. You know, had my kids, did the career, and then I learned of the master's meets. And then I said, oh, that would be so much fun. And it was so fun. It was really fun to sprint again after you haven't sprinted in 20 years, you know, except to catch a lamp that was falling over, you know. Very, very fun. And so to now know, you know, it's not worth a broken wrist anymore. It's not worth a blown out knee or whatever else might happen in a 40-some-year-old body. So I've made that decision, and I'm fine with that decision. But to say former athlete was a moment. Just say, okay, that part is over. Now, I agree with what you say. It's still a part of me. It's a huge part of me. And I'm thankful to be able to actually have it a part of my career, too, to look at athletics from an academic perspective. But I think we many people have the athletic identity as a huge part of their lives, and when it's taken away, that's an entire literature in and of itself. When athletes, due to injury or whatever reason, have to quit the sport that they have loved, and whether that's an adolescent or someone in college who now has to give up a scholarship, perhaps at other places, or a professional who now has to get another job, that athletic identity. Is something that changes and is something that sometimes athletes need help reinventing.
Well, thanks very much. This has been fascinating, Dr. Ertl. Thank you for being here, and thank you for staying off topic with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Kathy Giffray.
I'm Steve Hayward.
It's hard to imagine a position in sports that would be more stressful than being a relief pitcher. So you think about yourself standing there on that pitcher's mound, I would argue very much alone in the spotlight with all eyes focused on you.
The person who we wanted to talk to about the psychology of performance was the great Goose Gossage, one of the first so-called firemen pitchers who would come in at the end of the game expressly to end it. Goose has had a long and distinguished career. He played for 22 years and is really one of those revered figures in the game, one of those legendary figures known for somebody who could enter a game and get the job done.
If I pitch, can you catch? Will you hold the ball when you step to the plate?
Yeah, I'm Richard Michael Goose Gossage, and I reside here in Colorado Springs, born and raised, and I played baseball, Major League Baseball, for 22 years with 9 different teams, and was elected to the Hall of Fame in 2008. My type of pitching was power. You know, it was very exciting for me to be able to throw a ball the way I did. I think I was put on earth to be a pitcher and or to throw something. And, you know, from the time I was 8 years old, when I tried out for our neighborhood team, they said, you're going to be our pitcher.
Fee, fee, fi, fi, fo, fo, fum. I smell smoke in the auditorium.
As far back as I can remember, I was always throwing something. You know, I used to throw to my brother up at his house. I used to throw to him, and he used to say, you're a sissy.
Why is everybody always picking on me?
And I'd have tears in my eyes trying to throw the ball as hard as I could, using every muscle and every ounce of energy in my body. And I think that's really where my delivery came from, that violent delivery that I had. I kind of chalked that one up to my brother and, you know, calling me a little sissy and had tears. Like I said, I cried in his front yard trying to throw the ball so hard. And consequently, I had a lot of things going for me out there.
Can you talk a little bit about how the role of relief pitcher has changed since you were in the game and today?
When I started out in 1972, the bullpen was a place where you did not want to be.
Right.
It was like a junk pile down there where old starters went that couldn't start anymore.
Right.
And I had my sights, of course, like everyone else did, all the pitchers on a starting rotation or in, you know, you never really even heard about the bullpen. Like I said, it was a junk pile where old starters went that couldn't start anymore. And so when I came to the big leagues in 1972 under the, you know, tutelage of one of the greatest pitching coaches, and it was an amazing journey to run into Johnny Sane.
Right, yeah.
Sane, Spawn and Sane and Pray for Rain. He was of that combo way back in the 40s and stuff. And to run into him, he was the master of the off-speed pitch. And, man, to run into him at that juncture in my career, you know, I could throw it through a car wash without getting wet, but I had no idea of what an off-speed or a changeup or a curveball or a slider was.
I didn't know you guys had that much fun in the bullpen.
You got to believe in this little white demon, because when you grip it a certain way, it'll do exactly what you want it to do. Come here, I'll show you.
And he took me under his wing and taught me really everything that he knew. And, you know, and when I look back, I can't believe that I ran into this guy. And then I had a wonderful guy, Chuck Tanner, my manager, my first manager in the big leagues.
Yeah.
You know, and getting back to what I was going to say, you know, when I started out on this journey, when I got drafted by the Chicago White Sox upon graduating out of high school, all I wanted to do is, you know, I didn't know what I was getting myself into. I couldn't imagine getting guys out like Mickey Mantle and all the greats that I looked up to, Al Kaline and Frank Robinson and those kinds of hitters. I said, I don't know what I'm getting myself into. I can't get these guys out. You know, I knew I was good for around here, but I had no idea on a world level or facing those kinds of hitters what I was up against. But I promised myself that day that I signed that contract in my mom's living room that, you know, I'm going to give it my best shot. There aren't going to be any shoulda, woulda, couldas, if, ands, or buts. I'm going to give it my best shot and not look back. And, you know, in hindsight, you know, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. All I wanted to do is put a big league uniform on one time, and that one time turned into 22 years, and I still have to pinch myself that I had that kind of career. But, you know, the bullpen was not a place where you really wanted to be in 72, but I was in the big leagues. I would have cleaned the toilets. I would have done anything, you know. I couldn't believe that I made the ball club out of A-ball.
When you look back on your career, I can't think of anybody who's entered more high-pressure situations than you. Did you get nervous?
Oh, my God, yes. You know, I used to think about hearing Sinatra one time. He says, if you're not nervous, something's wrong. Well, the same holds true for the position, especially of a relief pitcher.
Yeah.
You know, anybody can pitch, and anybody, you know, a lot of guys can perform. But that pressure, you add that, and the magnitude of failure, the fear of failure is so great in all of us that we don't want to fail, especially in front of millions of people.
Yeah.
And I was at a golf tournament the other day, and, you know, somebody said, oh, man, this is scary. I said, hell, I've made an ass in front of millions of people. What's a couple hundred more, you know? And, you know, I think that fear of failure is so great in all of us that we don't want to fail. We don't want to let our team down, first of all. We don't want to, of course, let ourselves down. And, of course, the fans and the millions of people on TV that are watching us. So that fear of failure is so great. And, you know, I chalk it up as the greatest teacher is experience. And you have to go through those situations to be able to understand what you're up against and to control. I call it controlled aggression.
Controlled aggression.
Absolutely.
So what do you mean by that?
Because you've got to, you know, you tell kids to relax, but, you know, it's kind of a, you know, it's sending the wrong message because there is nothing relaxing about it.
So to tell kids to relax.
Yeah, it's it relax, but be aggressive. You know, it's like, whoa, what is that? Okay, you know, I'm going to be aggressive, and you have to be aggressive as a pitcher.
Yeah.
That fear of failure is so great in all of us. And once you fail and you know that the sun is going to come up, and once you fail and so many of those situations because you're either the hero or the goat.
Yeah.
There's no in between. You either do the job or you don't do it. And, you know, I've always said that every life's lesson is out there on that baseball field. I think we as parents and the parents out there today, I think we put too much emphasis on wins and losses. It's how we play the game. You know, if your son never makes it to the big leagues, he's going to be a better person, and he's going to be better at the job that he does because he played baseball.
Yeah.
Baseball is a game of failure. And, you know, what else can you fail at? You know, discussions.
Right. Yeah.
About, you know, what is the toughest thing on the planet to do? I believe baseball, hitting a baseball, is the toughest thing of any sport to do, because what else can you fail at? And I kind of end this discussion this way. I said, what else can you fail at 7 out of 10 times and still be doing what you want to do? And not only do what you want to do, but be a superstar at
right,
it.
Right.
A 300 hitter
exactly
fails 7 out of 10 times. So baseball sets you up for dealing with failure. It's how you deal with that failure that is going to directly affect how far you go in this game. Learning from your mistakes.
Right.
Building on the good. Learning from your mistakes and letting it go. People used to, and still do, ask me all the time, Goose, how are you such a great relief pitcher? I said, I had a short memory. I couldn't remember what the hell happened last night. So, you know, there's a lot of truth in that. And you know, I can tell you this, and I tell this to kids all the time, and is how you deal with that failure. If I come into a situation tonight with the bases loaded,
yeah,
and I give up a grand slam or I give up a home run, there's a couple guys on, we end up losing the ball game. Man, if I come in, I'm going to come back in this ball game the next night in the same situation possibly. If I'm thinking about the disaster that happened last night, it's going to happen again, just like clockwork. The power of thinking and thinking bad things. I tell kids, think good things and good things happen.
Right.
You think bad things and bad things are going to happen.
This is Off Topic. It's the Psychology of Performance episode. Stay with us.
This is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward.
And, you know, when we think about performance, what we've been talking about so far is a lot about sports, really thinking about sports performance, the pitcher at the mound. But when we think about someone who's standing alone in the spotlight, we could also think of other areas of life. For example, a conductor standing alone at the head of an orchestra.
And so we sat down with Scott Yu, who's a terrific conductor, world-famous conductor. We talked to him about some of the connections and some of the disconnections between, say, being on a mound and standing there in front of an orchestra with a baton in your hand.
Getting the most out of yourself or out of someone else is such a complicated topic because it requires sort of an alchemy of so many different factors. The main thing that's essential to play the violin well or conduct well is relaxation.
Relaxing perfectly. Every nerve, every muscle.
Relaxation.
Relaxation is the main element.
You are relaxing deeper.
Even if you want to play something that's the... If you want to play the most ferociously intense music, it requires relaxation to bring out the intensity. Because if you are as ferociously intense in your body as the music is, it won't come out being intense. It'll just come out as being stiff.
What about the whole idea of passion in music? When we think about huge, romantic, hair being pulled out, passion.
Sure.
That would seem to be the opposite of relaxation.
It isn't. It you're still this is, I think, one of the central things about any sport or any if you're Kirk Gibson and you're facing Dennis Eckersley and it's the ninth inning of the World Series.
Yes.
And look who's coming up.
If he tensed up when he was swinging at that pitch, or thought about the gravity of that pitch, he probably would have whiffed on that pitch. But he just sat back and just saw the ball, slowed the game down.
High fly ball into right field. She is gone!
And the ball just traveled out of the, you know, over the right fielder's head. If you are playing the most intense moment of the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto,
yeah,
and your body is seizing up because you're so excited, oh my God, isn't this awesome? It's just not going to be awesome.
How do you do that? How do you slow
it
down?
You have to slow it down. I mean, it's funny because whenever I hear batters talk about their at-bat and they said, I just slowed everything down. If you get caught up in the moment – Physically, there's a difference between getting caught up in the moment physically and getting caught up in the moment emotionally.
Right.
You have to be caught up in the moment emotionally, but physically, you can't. You have to separate the emotional and the physical. So, if you are in your bed and somebody comes in to your bedroom at night with a gun and says, "Okay, give me all your money," by reflex, your body's going to seize up, your hair is going to stand up, your adrenaline is going to pump, and you're going to be like, oh my God, okay, take it, here it is, go.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're faced with that sort of situation all the time when you play music, like in a concert, like
right.
at, let's say, an important concert.
Yeah.
But you have to divorce the physical element from the emotional element. It's funny, I did two performances last summer of the Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. They were both televised, and I watched both of them. I had videotaped them.
Yeah, yeah.
Watched both of them. And the second one, I thought that I was kind of sleeping on the podium. And the first one, I thought, oh, my God, I walked off the stage thinking, oh, my God, I left it all out there. It's unbelievable because it's the second concert that was the one that was much more powerful emotionally when I looked at it. Because the second one, I'd already done the first one, and I was a little tired, and I had the flu for the second one. So I was a little bit more relaxed, and somehow that was the one that was so powerful. And the first one was okay, it was good, but it looked tight.
Yeah.
It didn't look powerful.
And you were conducting for that?
Yes.
How does that work out in terms of being a conductor? In a sense, the orchestra is your instrument.
Right. The way I like to explain conducting to people is that it's about the flow of the music.
Right.
So what do I mean by that? What I mean is that when a pitcher pitches the ball, the batter either swings or doesn't, and then the umpire will give a call, strike or ball. If the umpire gives that call late, it's almost an interruption in the flow of the game. If the music is going along and it's soft, and then suddenly there's this huge outburst of sound, if I don't give something physically huge there, it's actually an interruption in the fabric of the music because I haven't given that. it disturbs the music. By not giving something huge, I am disturbing the music.
Huh.
And in a certain way, my job as a conductor is not to disturb what the composer wrote, to stay out of his way. No matter how good I am, I'm a good musician, but I'm an ant compared to Beethoven. I'm an ant compared to Mozart or
right.
Brahms or any Stravinsky. I mean, I'm just like an ant.
Well, isn't that the condition, though, of being in the present, feeling your antness?
Well.
I mean, I think we all feel like ants. I know I feel like an ant compared to Dickens, compared to Shakespeare.
I mean, that's...
I'm not actually an ant, though. Is that how it is a historical...
That's just how it is. I mean, I could never write anything like Brahms did. I mean, I'm just not... I don't have one thousandth of his talent.
Right.
Not one millionth of his talent. So, you know, my job is just to try to dust off... like one of those overhead projectors, so as much light can come from the bulb and hit the screen. That's my job.
This is Off Topic. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
Goose Gossage came into the studio, and it was incredible. He was so generous. He was so open. He gave us a perspective on the inside of the game that is really, really was unique.
And, you know, listening to these stories, I'm finding them just fascinating. Let's hear some more.
You talk about having a short memory. You talk about living for the day, being in the present. At the same time, baseball, if nothing else, has this wide historical consciousness of itself. And to ask you about looking back on your career, looking back on your performances, what is your, if you were to say, what were your, say, a couple of performances on the field that stick with you, that you look back, if you were to look back, you say, oh, that was all right.
Well, gosh, I faced so, every situation I faced was do or die. You know, of course, the biggest save that I got was the 78 Boston playoff game. Amazing. I'd never faced that kind of pressure. Especially, you know, you couldn't have written up a better script. Yankees, Red Sox, the hatred we had for them and they had for us to play it in Fenway Park. Oh, my God. you know, we were 14 games out in August, and we ended up catching the Red Sox and forcing a one-game playoff. We had identical records when the season was finally over, and we had to face the Red Sox in Boston. And let me tell you, if there's one stadium in the world you do not want to, you know, play a one-game playoff, would be Fenway, because no lead in that ballpark is a safe lead.
Right.
So I came into that ball game in the seventh inning. I was so nervous, I couldn't even hardly put one foot in front of the other to get to the mound.
And really,
it was amazing, and the adrenaline was just incredibly. It was incredible. How it was pumping through my body at that time, and I thought, man, this is what you went to bed last night thinking that you're going to be facing Yastrzemski for the final out.
Yeah.
That was I fast forwarded to the ninth inning, but I went to bed thinking that I'm going to be facing Yaz for the final out. Well, I got out of the jam in the seventh, two runners on, and then in the eighth inning, I gave up two quick runs to make it 5-4. I came in the game, it was 5-1.
Right.
I came into the game, or 5-2. I gave up two quick runs, it made it 5-4. And now the ninth inning rolls around. I give up a couple of base hits. I've got two runners on, and guess who comes up to the plate with two outs? And it's Carl Yastrzemski. And the last guy that you really would want to face in that situation. Great, great player. Of course, a Hall of Famer, and I had a few minutes there to have a little conversation with myself. And
what did you
when
say?
When it came to the plate, and I said, well, this is what you went to bed thinking last night, that you're going to be facing Yastrzemski for the final out. Well, here it is. I said, why are you so nervous? I was asking myself questions and answering questions, and I said, you know, why are you so nervous? You know, you've never been this nervous in your whole life, and you've always played the game for the fun of it and the love of it. And it went back to, you know, the first time I picked up a baseball and tried out for my team, and I said, you're going to be our pitcher. And And I really did have those thoughts and asking questions. And I said, what's the worst thing that can happen to you? And all this time, Yastrzemski's standing there with a standing ovation for a few minutes. And, you know, I get to talk this, have this talk with myself. And I said, what's the worst thing that can happen to you? And I said to myself, well, I'll be back in Colorado tomorrow elk hunting, you know. Yeah. And it just put perspective, put the game in perspective about what it is. It's a game, and it's not do or die or life or death, you know. And I'm not getting shot at. I'm not in a war. I wasn't in Vietnam. Yeah. Was, you know, it's a silly game. And it was the first time all day that I had taken a deep breath. And I stepped back on the mound. Yastrzemski stepped up to the plate, and the first pitch to him was down in the zone, and I knew it was the hardest pitch I'd thrown all day because I finally relaxed. And the next pitch was pretty much down the middle of the plate, but I had tremendous velocity on it, and it kind of tailed in on him, and he's a left-handed hitter, and he popped it up to Nettles at third base right. for the third out. And then we went on, and it felt like, you know, the playoffs with the Kansas City Royals where we went the next day, and the World Series with the Dodgers after we went through Kansas City. We beat them and then went on to play the Dodgers in the World Series and beat them. Those playoff games in the World Series seemed like a spring training game.
Compared
like
to
an
the,
exhibition game compared to that single playoff game. You know, I always said that my career was like a 10-year-old kid going to Disney World and waiting in an out line for 2 hours to get on your favorite ride. Mm-hmm. And that ride lasts for 1 minute. I got on my favorite ride, and it lasted for 22 years. And I still have to pinch myself. I wish that every great fan could do what I did and have that experience. I was a fan. I still am a fan. And I wish that everybody could experience what I experienced. You know, even the home runs I gave up were great. And believe me, I gave up my share of home runs.
All right, listen, thanks for talking to us. Thanks for taking the time.
You bet. My pleasure.
Next, we hear from off-topic contributor Idris Goodwin about a experience, a not altogether pleasant experience he had while teaching performance in a public school.
I was about 25. And somehow I'd managed to land a job interview at Chicago's very progressive Perspectives Charter School. Perspectives Charter School was looking for an 8th grade speech and drama teacher. Now at the interview, they asked me about my approach to discipline. So of course I was like, I'll make them wear the dunce caps. I'll make them slap the erasers. I will publicly ridicule them. I am a company man. Now I had done some teaching before, but mostly like teen writing workshops and cool community centers. And so I was used to these very loose, dreamy artist kids. And we would just sort of look out the window and wait for inspiration to slap us upside the head. And so I was very well accustomed to wearing my pajamas at noon. But at Perspectives Charter School, this would be like a daily thing. I would have to like set an alarm. I would have to like look presentable, carry myself with decency. And these kids that I would be teaching would not be dreamy artists. These kids would be like we were in the 8th grade. Terrible. But teaching them would be a small price to pay, for I needed socks without holes. Teaching is like the ultimate performance for an audience that would rather be elsewhere. So on day one, I'm standing there before these 20 blue uniformed kids, little girls with their hair all pressed into colorful barrettes and boys with their shirt tails hanging out of their pants. And I'm standing there and I'm watching them and I'm watching them watch me. But I'm not gonna crack. I'm over planning and I'm over explaining. I'm improvising and I'm diverting. And some days I'm just throwing Hail Marys into the ether and crossing my fingers. I was not gonna let these little kids see me sweat, even when the classroom was clearly on fire. Now, my main fire starter was this kid named Michael Young. And little Michael Young was like the resident wise ass of the class. He had this like kind of young Fresh Prince of Bel-Air thing that worked really well for him, but I didn't like that. That was supposed to be my shtick. So I had to show Michael Young that he couldn't encroach on my terrain. So I was maybe a little tougher on Michael than some of the other kids, but only like a bit. I just really got a kick out of kind of knocking him off his little Fonzarelli pedestal. And the other students really liked watching me do this because they felt eclipsed by Michael's swagger. My ability to steal Michael's fire away from him helped me build trust with the rest of the class. And so the weeks began to pass a little quicker and the classes went a little smoother. But then one day, Michael Young caught me slipping. Hey, Mr. Goodwin, where's my pen? What pen? I said. You didn't have a pen yesterday, so I loaned you mine. It was my favorite pen, and you said you'd give it back. Mr. Goodwin, where's my pen? And I shook my head and kind of shifted my feet. Give it back? I'm sure I gave it back. And that was kind of the end of it for the moment. Did I take Michael's pen? Probably. I don't remember exactly. Maybe. But every single day from that point, Michael would ask me loudly so the whole class would hear, Mr. Goodwin, where's my pen? I would be in the middle of making some really, really profound point and the kids would be on the edge of their seats and here's Michael. Hey, Mr. Goodwin, did you find my pen? Where's my pen? You took my pen. And slowly, Michael starts regaining his fire because he had convinced the kid, he had shown the kids that I was not this protector of justice, that I was basically just a guy who needed a job. I was pulling off the biggest act of all. And so slowly, Michael was back on his pedestal. Very well played. Now, during the last few days of the program, I had to discipline Michael. He had done like something like kick a trash can or something. And at Perspectives Charter School, they take discipline very seriously. So any minor infraction was a major infraction. So of course, Michael's father shows up to the school. Now Michael's father was exactly what you imagine him to be. He was this giant, imposing, intimidating, blue-collar stereotype of a man. And the look on his face said it all. He did not like to be pulled away from, you know, whatever he was doing before. And I'm looking at Michael standing by his giant father, and Michael looked smaller than I'd ever seen him. And he just looked like he knew he was in for it. I suddenly thought about my own father coming to the school to hear about whatever act I was pulling off. And so I said, well, you know, I tried to diffuse it. I said, well, Mr. Young, you know, Michael, we were doing some improv. Michael got carried away. He's a very good performer. He's very dedicated. The kids love him. You know, it's my fault. I'm new to this. You know, I'm only 25. I'm used to artist kids, blah, blah, blah. And then I looked at Michael Young and I kind of shrugged and was like, that's the best I'm going to do for you, kid. And Michael sort of shrugged and smiled back at me. And then he looked up at his father and he said, this is the one I told you about, Dad. This is the guy who stole my pen.
That was Idris Goodwin reading a piece from his collection of essays, These Are the Breaks.
Off Topic is produced by Craig Richardson and Jake Brownell with help from the Tim Gill Center for Public Media, a part of Rocky Mountain PBS, in association with Colorado College and KRCC in Colorado Springs.
For more information or to download any of our episodes, to download any part of this episode that you might have missed, you can find us at www.offtopicradio.org. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
And until next week, stay off topic.